Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to An Hour of Mind Power. And we're going to be taking it to a little bit of a different level today because my guest, who is Seth Santoro, has put together a book called How I Learned to Smile from the Inside. Now, the title is a little bit, what do I want to say, intriguing, because smiling from the inside gives you a particular visual. But when you've gone through experiences like almost being kidnapped twice, a number of friends dying within a very short period of time, and some other things that he went through, one might say, how in the world can one have an attitude of being willing to even smile from the inside? And when you think of so many things that are going on today, it's so easy to become the doom and gloom attitude, presentation, whatever term you want to use. So my guest today, Seth Santoro, is going to share with us some of the experiences that he had and how he was able to make them work for him, not against him. Seth, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Seth, you're quite an interesting man. Your background is very diversified. But you wrote this book because you really feel that people need to understand that it's what they do with what happens to them that makes the difference in their lives. When you started writing this book, what compelled you? I mean, a lot of people go through experiences and they tie them up inside themselves in big knots and they never ever talk about experiences. And you wonder, why is it that someone like you would opt to write about this?
The interesting thing is it happened as I was running to a plane in Mexico City, getting back to my boyfriend at the time who just had told me that he was HIV positive. And I was running, and all of a sudden at the end, as I was getting to the seat, it was 24, which is my favorite number, and it was, you know, I think a universe saying, this is where you're supposed to be right now. And then the next thought was, why don't I write a book about being in this situation and how to, I mean, I didn't know how I was going to deal with it at that point, but to move forward through it, I really wanted to document what happened to me and really challenge myself to see my process, and then hopefully, in essence, I could help others with their processes.
You have what you call the SMILE method, and you've broken down S-M-I-L-E, and the S stands for shock, the M stands for mock acceptance, the I stands for an overwhelmdom, L for learning, and E for embrace. Your story, and you're very candid in your book about the experiences that you have, and I really liked your candor. And one of the small sentences, three words, is life sucks sometimes. And I thought, boy, does that resonate with just about everybody. I mean, that is the terminology that the younger generation uses, and the older generations really say, oh, that's so uncouth. But really, it is just a reality. Life can hit us in so many different ways, and it can be so downright ugly. And I thought, yes, this is what we have to be aware of. This is something, we're not in la-la land here. This is like a big school as far as I'm concerned. We go through all of these different lessons, if you will, to find out what we're made of. And by golly, that is what you get to, because in the process of your walking the walk of experience, You found you really had to have integrity with yourself as a man, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, one of my major points is that pain will always be with you. Pain is inevitable. You know, but suffering is your choice. Suffering is optional.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as hard as it may be at times, I mean, I choose to do better and be better and learn. And it's not always the easiest thing to do.
Now, what is Mensch? M-E-N-S-C-H?
Oh, God, my mother. It's a Yiddish word, which means a very good person, a very decent human being who walks with integrity.
Now, how did I pronounce it correctly?
Yes, you did. Mensch, yeah.
Mensch? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, my education now has been added. Because in the... added, too. This is a word that you bring out in your book right in the beginning, and you say you consider it an amazing word, and just like you said, it represents a person of integrity and honor, and this is something that's very important. But you describe yourself as a reframer. Now, anyone that's associated or has had an association with neuro-linguistic programming, that terminology is very much a part of NLP. Is that what you're referring to when you talk about reframing?
No. For me, it's changing how people view what they're seeing, what they're observing, what they're going through, and on a math level, you know. So I think in my life, I mean, I always, you know, no matter what, when I feel stuck, I know that there's some way to get out of it, and I just need to follow the roadmap, which in my case is the SMILE method. You know, so on a grand scale, I really want other people to just read the book. I mean, and again, it's not, as you know, it's not, I'm not preaching to anyone. I'm not saying you have to do this. I'm just saying this is what worked for me, and I hope it works for everyone else. So, you know, shifting people's views and visions on how they go through their colorful past, if you will, you know, is where I feel like reframing really fits.
Let's take the first segment, shock.
Okay.
Because you, like you say in your book, you had a whole series of particular circumstances that slammed you very, very hard. And the first one was being told that you had superficial spreading malignant melanoma. Now, try saying that 45 times.
I know.
Well, I mean, that was amazing to me. Superficial spreading. Malignant melanoma.
She didn't even tell me to sit first. I mean, she just told me.
I mean, this was something else. Now, how was this discovered? How did you find out that this was your skin cancer? I mean, what was it that motivated you to go and have this checked out?
It was actually a roommate at the time. He had sworn by this Beverly Hills Skin Clinic. And he said, you know, it's a good idea because I've had, like, pre-cancerous cells. And he said, you have moles all over your body. And I was like, okay, I'll check it out. And long and behold, I mean, really, after about seven, they removed, they're very aggressive in their treatment. They removed about seven other moles, which happened to be precancerous. And then the number eight or number nine was the malignant melanoma.
Mm-mm-mm.
So it was really just by chance, thank God, because it would have. It was the leading, you know, cause of death with skin cancer is malignant melanoma. So, and it's the deadliest of most cancers, actually. So, thank God we caught it in stage one.
Well, it's interesting to be aware of this because I had a very special friend whose wife had melanoma, and her story was just amazing, but eventually it did take her life. But I listen, you know, as I'm reading your story, and I'm thinking of all of the things you went through with this and how you had to deal with the impersonal demeanor of some of the medical staff, and dealing with the reality that this was something that was serious, that did need to be taken care of, and how you manage it, that was something that would you know, was very, very important. So with anyone listening today, I mean, you're talking about having quite a few moles on the body. What would you say to someone that maybe is curious? What do they need to look for?
I mean, I do know that I did, amazingly enough, in seventh grade, I did a project on melanoma and how to recognize it. You know, I swear. See, everything happens for a reason. And, you know, it's that check the ABCs. You know, it's for asymmetry, so if it's a little bit bigger than normal. You know, I mean, and then the list goes on and on. I mean, if it's bigger than, what's it, A, B, C, C is the color. You know, if the color is a little darker than black, usually that's an indication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, luckily I've been going to my dermatologist and my oncologist pretty much every 3 to 6 months for the past 7 years. So, you know, I have them check me out. And I'm the biggest, obviously the biggest advocate for going to get your mold checked. If you know, usually, again, it's also for people with lots of mold. I'm half Italian, and Italians have lots of mold on them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's the key. So for those of you that are listening, this is something that, because of what he goes through in his book and what he expresses, this is something that I think is an aha for anyone listening, and maybe for a loved one. So this is very good information. But you're going through that, and then you went through just so many unusual things. One, you had a relationship with someone, and they ended up having HIV, and you didn't. And that was, boy, the story about what you went through with that process of being advised in a medical clinic that this was happening, and that was pretty intense for you.
Very, very intense. You know, especially since I thought we were monogamous.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not just a betrayal. It was also like, oh, my God, you could have really endangered my life at the end of the day. Yeah, that was the scariest. I mean, I encourage people to get HIV tests all the time, you know, but that was the scariest. It turned out to be 5 or 6 days. It was supposed to be 3 days. And of course, my concern was him. It was not even, I mean, I couldn't even really focus on me. Maybe that was my own little shock, you know, or my own mock acceptance. But I really was concerned about him and how he was dealing with it. And then when I got the clear and the go-ahead that, you know, I'm fine, I was beyond elated, but then at the same time, my first breath was complete elation and exhaustion, you know, but my second breath was, oh my God, now our lives are going to change forever because, well, for one, you know, he cheated on me inside somehow. Secondly, our whole lives in the bathrooms had to change, you know, I mean, you have to change everything, can't
of
share
course.
Things, or you want to be as protective as possible. So, serious emotional trip. I mean, I had to take a couple weeks off of work. You know, I mean, I could barely focus.
So you had another situation where
one after another.
First, you had the situation with melanoma. Then you have this other situation, and it's almost as if the gods of the universe are saying, "Excuse me, I think you need to pay attention to some things here." And you're going, but did I really need this? Thank you very much. You've hit me in the head once. Why are you doing it to me a second time? Well, you ended up with a couple of other situations that came up.
Right.
And this really was mind-boggling. It's about Mexico. You were the head of a security force down in Mexico. And you went through two situations where you were very close to being kidnapped.
Right.
And the cartels, your information on the cartels in your book was terrifying. And that there are women cartels, not just guys, but the gals. I mean, we've got pistol packing mamas that are down there, but it's not 45, thank you very much. It's M1s and machine guns. I mean, this is something else. Tell us about this.
Yeah, and you know what, it's not One of the focuses of my book and then my next book, which is going to be primarily about all of my experiences in Mexico, including a couple, like my bodyguard was kidnapped afterwards as well. But as you know, for me, I really, it's war. There's a war going on. It's not really terrorism. It's a war, and it's a war between a couple different groups. It's the government on one side. It's the cartels on the other, and the military on another. You know, and then the police don't even factor in because they can be bought either way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a war going down there, and we had armored vehicles. You know, I was growing citrus down there, and we really. We were pulled over all the time, it was routine. It was, you know, with the federales, like the state troopers, if you will, or the military. And because we had armored vehicles, we had to get it registered as well. So, you know, it wasn't an out of the ordinary thing to be pulled over. However, this time, when we were pulled over, within about 5 minutes, four other cars showed up. And they were regular policemen, and I was very nervous from the very beginning, you know. And in Mexico, you have to get out of your cars as soon as they pull you over, so they know exactly who's in there. And then they asked us to actually pull over, and then they pulled a paddy wagon in front of the vehicle, so you couldn't even see us, which really terrified me, you know. And then, not even the six automatic weapons that were on my head at the time. That wasn't even what was scary to me. It was the fact that, oh, my God, what's going to happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I had a feeling that they didn't really want me, per se, but you never know. You know, I mean, kidnappings happen all the time. I knew that they really wanted a vehicle. You know, and it was very scary. And then finally, after about 10, 15 minutes, the big boss showed up, sized me up, you know, asked me 4,000 questions up and down, ransacked the vehicle, which is another indication that it definitely was not the military or the police.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the military and police would always put everything neatly back, but these people just left the van as it was. I mean, things thrown around. He went so far as to open up my laptop and say, what do you have pictures of on here? You know? So it was, you know, there was a stare down, and the only way out... For me, I don't know what happened, but I just thought to myself, how do I get out of the situation? So I reached for my phone, but the guns got closer to me, and he said, what are you doing? And obviously this is all in Spanish. And I said, I'm going to call Lieutenant Enriquez, because he told me if I was ever in trouble or if I ever felt uncomfortable to call him and he'd be here soon. And like everyone looked kind of scared, so I knew it was the right name. And he said, how do you know him? You know, and I said, oh, he comes to the ranch all the time. And then, like, we had a 2-minute stare down, and I thought I was going to pee my pants. I mean, it was insane.
Mm-hmm.
And then he barely did a nod, and literally within 30 to 45 seconds, everyone was gone. Peeled out, everyone was gone.
Amazing.
And then I collapsed. After everything happened, I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe that just happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I laugh about it now, but, you know, my blood
was
pumping.
Well, this sounds like something out of a Clint Eastwood movie or Mission Impossible,
exactly.
But there you are. You're actually living it. And
right.
Some of the points that you brought out, and I just thought, my goodness, I remember hearing about different things in Mexico years ago and how Americans often were targeted because... Mm-hmm. They could use them for ransom or what have you. They were thrown in jails. They could rot there. There was no due process. And your information in the book is very specific. You say the cartels, the Mexican cartels, go around terrorizing both the Mexican people and the government, and that the threat of being carjacked or kidnapped, it's never gone. And every cartel has its own special signature, technique of how they're going to terrorize you. And you felt that this group that came after you were the Zetas, and they were considered the most deadly of the cartel. So in a way, it reminds me of what used to go on in the United States, and it's still going on to a degree. You had the mafias, and you had the Sicilian, you had the Jewish mafia, you had the Irish mafia, you had all of these different people. and they were all competing with each other for turf and for territory. And Mexico has been renowned for this for centuries. Centuries. But the cartels have really gotten huge, and you say it is a war. And you really, that's one of the things that you want to bring to the attention to the American public, because the politicians are just totally ignoring this. This is a war, and it's right at our borders. Then they have crossed over into the U.S., and we've got to pay attention.
So much so that I even thought about writing this under a pen name, because I didn't know, I mean, the details that I have in here, you know, I mean, I will never return to Mexico. I will never. And that's only because I'm scared of being on, I'm on their list. You know, they have my name, my number, my address. I mean, they, you know, for my safety, I'll never go back there.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in your book that close to 50,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence. And fortunately, there is some good that's coming back. Some people are trying to fight against it. But it is a war. It is not something which is happening occasionally. This is a day-to-day basis. And you say
it's
reason,
a silent war.
Yeah, and the reason that there were, what, like 40 people killed in one incident, just slaughtered. And the reason it didn't get on the news programs is because it is the cartels, and they are so vicious, they'll go after anyone.
Anyone, especially reporters.
Mm-hmm.
No one talks about it. No, everyone knows what's going on, but no one ever talks about it. It's the strangest and eeriest of sensations being down there.
Mm-hmm.
Which I tried not to think about when I was down there, to be honest, because I had a job to do and I wanted to get in and get out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. So you had these experiences, and then you were also in New York on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really fascinated with the change that occurred in the environment of the New York population, as you described it, because you're a New Yorker. You live there, you love the people. You're now in Los Angeles, that's where you're living, but at the time you were living there. And New York is an awesome place. It really is.
Awesome.
I love New York. I love Manhattan. Yep. I just think that people in New York are wonderful. But New York had a reputation for a long, long time, and I think New Yorkers sort of wanted it to look that way, where they say New Yorkers just are so impersonal. And, of course, they're not that way at all. But by golly, after 9/11, you said that the people in New York wouldn't take any nonsense off of any creeps, like in the subway. And so the outgoing demeanor, where most of the time they'd be sort of quiet to themselves, not anymore. After 9/11, there was a big shift. Tell us about that, some of your experiences.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as 9/11 was happening, I mean, the sparkle kind of left, I think, New York for at least a couple months. You know, and restaurants were closed, things were closed. And then slowly and surely, you know, people started to go out again. People started to, things were, started to reopen. We all knew what was going on. We were all conscious of it. But we definitely, we all knew that we were going to be the only ones to make it happen, to make New York back to where it was, or better than what it was. You know, and multiple times, I mean, and it's no joke, like on the subway, you know, there'd be quote-unquote crazies who'd run amok and, you know, maybe they're schizophrenic or whatever, but they would just be running their mouths and saying all sorts of profanity. And several times, including myself, people would be like, you know what, not today. Like, not right now. I mean, just, you know, calm down. Not in a yelling way, just in like, we don't want to hear it. You know, you're making people feel uncomfortable. You know, and I knew that New Yorkers were direct, but this is like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and hopefully, you know, I mean, that stayed for as long as I was there. I stayed there for 4 or 5 more years until I moved here. So, I mean, I really think that it was just a matter of, you know what, like, we've learned our lesson, and we're not going to accept anything that's not amazing and, you know, excellent.
And that, I think, the story in and of itself and the various perceptions that you had about the environment that you were in, and people dealing with the grief and the various ways that they dealt with the grief, the trauma, the feeling of being overwhelmed, realizing there were some things that they couldn't control, and the resiliency of people, and the willingness to say, all right, what do we do from here? Where do we go from here? What do we do with what we are involved with at this moment? And being willing to assist each other. And you had, because of the way you were raised, and it reminds me of my background, the way I was raised, you always have extra food. There's always, it's sort of like the depression mentality they talk about. Well, when it's been in your family and you're taught this, you do that. And you had extra food, you had things, and you were willing to share as well as so many others, saying, okay, we're all in the same boat together. Let's see how we can work this out. And that is part of what you gained from that experience. And all of this seemed to be in a life framing. It was like one scenario after another with you. And you said, Jeeves, we've got to realize that we have to choose our emotions, and we need to be mindful about how we respond to it. And your book is loaded with all of these wonderful stories about dealing with trauma. And I loved your bunny, Buster. I thought Buster was just awesome. I mean, I mean, this is really good. The bunny Buster. Maybe I should say Buster the Bunny.
Buster Bunny, yeah.
He just was an amazing teacher for you. And I thought that story was so charming because you said here that Buster taught you that being alone is A-okay and there's nothing wrong with sitting by yourself and chewing a spoonful of peanut butter. And I said, there's wisdom with that rabbit. And you got it. You got it. I think that so many times that we're so busy being busy that we don't realize it's okay not to be busy. You know, it's just part of, I think, being in the American environment. That's just something that we do. We feel like we've got to be industrious all the time without realizing that sometimes we have to have the downtime. And you talk about some wonderful people in your life, Santiago and Max and Vinny and Luli. I mean, all of these beautiful people that ended up passing away. And each of them, you give the gift of the wonderful friendship that they shared with you and how each of them were just such a light in your life and how important those significant people are and how important it is to remember them and to honor them. And I just think your book has so much in it for someone to enjoy, and you just say, this is my gift to you. Do you have a website, Seth, that people can go to?
I do, yep. It's SethSantoro.com or SmileFromTheInside.com.
All right, Seth Santoro, that's SantoroO.com, and or How I Learned to Smile from the Inside, and that'll get you there, too. Seth, is there a thought you'd like to leave with my audience before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I mean, I really want everyone to really think about, you know, that no matter what your colorful or challenging past, you know, it does not have to inform and shape your future, your present or your future. You know, again, suffering is a choice.
And, well, I think your stories are just wonderfully stated.
Thank you.
And your candor and your openness and your sense of humor, everything including the bunny, is just really it's really something to read and be thoughtful about, because I think just about everybody goes through experiences of their own, and I think you're taking the time to put it down in book form so people could take it with them on a plane or summer's coming, just have a good read.
Right.
Gives insight and information on so many levels. Thank you, Seth Santori.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. How I Learned to Smile from the Inside. Very interesting book. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedros accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
If you are an author and would like to be a guest on the Donna Sebo Show, please send a review copy of your publication along with a press release to the Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. Allow 6 to 8 weeks for your material to be reviewed. Again, the address to send your material to is the Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Darlene Price. We're going to be talking about being a speaker and what you can do to, well, be, first of all, comfortable with public speaking. For many people, that is a big, big fear. Some people even say it is the number one fear that people have, is getting up in front of others and presenting whatever their subject matter might be. So we're going to be talking with Darlene tomorrow, and then Making Your Shift with Beverly Flaxton, wanting to shift your life. Well, by golly, you can do that. But what if you're wanting to do something with a career? Can you do that too? Yes, and we're going to have some pointers on that. And then Friday is going to be an open mic day, so we'll be talking with you on Friday. Phone lines will be open for the entire hour. Donna Sebo here, 888-627-6008. If you would like to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. What would you do if someone that you knew went into a trance and stayed that way for a number of years? No, I'm not kidding. I'm really saying that. What if something happened? Not a coma, but a trance. Now, let me share with you a story. It took place in 1866. The date that this unusual phenomena occurred was on February the 3rd. There was a young woman, her name was Molly Francher. Healthy, nothing wrong with her. She felt a little dizzy. She lost consciousness, was found on her mother's kitchen floor. She was in an altered state of mind for 46 years. This is all documented. This isn't mumbo jumbo. Now, during those 46 years, she ate very little, and she demonstrated a very unusual talent. Now, this is how the story goes. There was a family physician, and of course, in the 1800s, the doctors went to the house. They examined young Molly the day after she fainted. Her pulse, her breathing, was negligible. The body itself felt very, very cold to the physician. For nine years, Molly seemingly hovered between life and death. And in the medical profession, it really became a very significant case. because they didn't understand anything that was going on. Well, Dr. Speer apparently was a man with astute observation powers. And he said, Molly has been taken over by something because she has a supernatural power. Now, what does supernatural mean? It means something beyond our comprehension, something that we are attributed to whatever it was. We just didn't know what it was. And what he found as a physician is that Molly was able to see people over 100 miles away as well as read unopened letters and books. That's right. Now, the first, in today's world, we'd call remote viewing. It also could apply at being able to read things that are not open. And this is something sometimes people go through a lot of training to be able to do. Now, there are a lot of people that witnessed Molly's unique gifts. There was a very famous astronomer. His name was Richard Parkhurst. And there was also a neurologist who was highly respected. His name was Willard Parker. They would go to Molly's bedside, and two tests that they have documented were conducted. Molly was asked about a message that was in a building. So they set this up in advance. Was asked about a message in a building that was at least 5 miles away. And Molly would talk. She was in this altered state. And she whispered to them, it's a letter in 3 sealed envelope in Dr. Speer's office. And she said these words. Written on a sheet of paper are the words, Lincoln was shot by a crazed actor. She was 100% correct. Another test that was done, she was asked to describe someone's brother who lived in New York City. She gave a very detailed description, even mentioning a missing button from the right sleeve of his coat. She also said that he had left work early because of a headache. Now, in 1912, after her parents and Dr. Speer had died, Molly regained consciousness, 46 years in this state. Now, she was known worldwide. The condition, they never, ever could explain it. 3 years later, she passed away in her sleep at the age of 73. So for most of her life, her physical vehicle was used by another energy, and that's the term I will use, as a communicating resource. A very strange story. All of it is documented. And she lived to the ripe old age of 73. Fascinating facts. A lot of things go on in life that we honestly don't have an understanding of in what I'd call the scientific sense. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call into. And by the way, all I need from you is your first name, or your initial, and then, of course, after that, I'll tell you what I perceive. And then you're welcome to ask me about anything that you like. Now, by the way, Memorial Day is going to be coming up, and we're all going to be enjoying the holiday. But I have a wonderful, wonderful rib recipe that I want to share with you. So you might want to get a pad of paper and a pen so you can write it down. But it's just, I love ribs. I just think that they are so delicious. It's one of our favorite meats at the Sipo household, and quite often I'll fix it in the oven, and I just let it cook very, very slowly for a long period of time where it's just literally the meat's falling away from the bones themselves. But this has got a certain rub to it and other components that I think that you will enjoy a great deal, so I'll share that with you in just a moment. F. Scott Fitzgerald, who wrote The Great Gatsby, says, and so with the sunshine and the great bursts of leaves growing on the trees, just as things grow in fast movies, I had that familiar conviction that life was beginning over again with the summer. That was by F. Scott Fitzgerald, a wonderful, wonderful writer. And, oh, everything here in the Pacific Northwest has just evolved with a lushness of various hues of green and, of course, all of the colors of the flowers. It's just incredibly wonderful. It's a delight to live vibrancy with color in spring. We just love it here. Okay, let me give you the recipe for Cuban-style smoked pork ribs. And they are slow-cooked because when you cook your ribs slowly, your marinades, your rubs, whatever you put on them, really get into the meat. And, of course, there's that wonderful smoky flavor that can be added to it as well. And also, there are a number of people, we have some very good friends that love to use the smoker units, and they'll pick their wood. They will pick maybe certain apple woods and other kinds of woods that create a particular flavor with the meat as well. But this is what you're going to need for your meat. And this is rubbed. You're going to need 3 racks of pork spare ribs. And your racks, because of the bones, are going to be weighing about 3 pounds each. And you've seen them in the store. They're pretty long. And anyway, you're going to need about 1/4 cup of ground annatto or paprika. And this is your rub. 1/4 cup of ground annatto or paprika. 2 tablespoons of ground cumin. 2 tablespoons of kosher salt. 2 tablespoons of freshly cracked pepper. 2 tablespoons of minced fresh garlic. And you're going to need 2 tablespoons of olive oil. So you want to take all of those spices and put it all in a bowl, and before you put your rub on, you want to rub your ribs with your oil, and then coat the spices on the ribs, just gently pressing them in, and that's when you'll put it on the grill, or if you wanted to do it in the oven, you could have big baking sheets, what I use, and have it with the raised sides like your jelly roll pans. Line them with foil because that makes cleanup easier. And you'd need 2 good size baking pans. And just for the heck of it, I'd spray the foil with a little bit of cooking spray. Put your ribs in because they're all rubbed with the spices. And then put them in a slow oven if you want to do it in the oven, depending on where you live. But if you have a grill, it's really great. And you're going to cook them on the grill very, very slowly. It's going to take 3 to 4 hours to come out on the grill, and it's the same in the oven, and I would say anywhere between, 225 to 250 in your oven. You don't cover the meat with foil in the oven. You just let it do its process. Just let those spices do their work. And if you really want the spicy flavor to permeate the meat, you can put the spice on the night before, put it in your pans if you've got a refrigerator big enough, and just put it in the refrigerator and let the marinade, the spice, go down into the meat. Cover everything with saran wrap and then maybe foil and put it in the fridge and just let it marinate overnight. Then the flavor is going to be a little bit stronger. Now, this is a sauce that goes with it that's absolutely awesome. You're going to need a ripe mango. Of course, you have to peel it, seed it, and dice it. You're going to need 1/2 cup of olive oil, 1/4 cup of white vinegar, 1/2 cup of olive oil, 1/4 cup of white vinegar, juice of 2 limes, which will be about 1/4 cup. And you need 1/4 cup of roughly chopped fresh cilantro and 2 tablespoons of your favorite minced fresh chili pepper of your choice, and then 1 tablespoon of minced fresh garlic and a little bit of kosher salt and freshly cracked pepper, to your own taste, of course. And you combine your sauce ingredients in a bowl and put it to the side, and then you can serve the sauce by itself, and it's a wonderful compliment. I would just say take the sauce if you're like me and you're lazy. Once you have all your ingredients, just put it in your blender and zap it. Let your blender just do all of that. And this, too, is a sauce that you could, if you wanted to, make it the night before, but leave out the mango and then blend the mango in just before you serve it. Put it back in the blender, put your mango in, and it's going to be just delicious. So it's something, you've got something here you can prepare in advance if you're going to be having a good-sized crowd and fix everything so it's just ready to do whatever you need to do with. Remember, if you take your ribs out of the refrigerator, you want to be sure to let them set at room temperature until they come up to the temperature of the environment that you're in, and then put them in the grill rather than putting them on the grill when they're cold. It makes a difference. So anyway, Those are some tips. That is a Cuban-style smoked pork rib. Delicious. And, of course, who doesn't enjoy good food? And I'm going to have some other good things to share with you this week as well. How about grilled corn with cilantro lime butter? Yum. We all love grilled corn. Anyway, this is Donna Sebo taking a break, 888-627-6008. And when we come back, I'm going to have some other things to share with you, so don't go away.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Have you ever had a paranormal experience, such as seeing a ghost, having precognitive dreams, out-of-body experiences, or other happenings? If so, Donna would like to hear from you. She's putting together a book of 100 stories from people who would like to tell their story. If you'd like to submit yours, send an email to donna@delphiinternational.com. Again, send your story to donna@delphiinternational.com. Be sure to include your contact information as well. Thank you.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I'm so delighted you're with me today, and I want you to know if you'd like to give me a call so we can chat, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. You know, when you listen to the show on a regular basis, I thoroughly enjoy the resourcefulness of people and how they will take something, just like our guest earlier, and where he decided to write his book and share his story. Well, there are people that decide to take action of a different type. Now, there's a woman by the name of Cass Forkin, and she was having lunch with her 16-year-old daughter, Jessica, when she noticed some ladies, three sweet white-haired ladies, sitting at an adjacent table. And they were counting up their change because they had a bill, obviously. They had had a meal, and they were figuring out what they needed to do to pay for everything on the bill. Well, Cass thought to herself, my goodness, these are elderly ladies. They obviously don't have a whole bunch of money. And so she called the waitress over that served her and said, look, here's $20. Go and help. Add this to their bill. This is my gift to them. She said, I don't want you to tell them who is given the money, but I want the bill to be taken care of. Well, guess what? The waitress didn't keep her mouth shut. The waitress told the lady about the woman who had donated $20 towards the payment of the bill. Well, all three of these ladies came over to her, and they were just hugging her, saying, thank you so much. They were so grateful. Well, Cass did some thinking about this. She said, this gave me so much satisfaction. I really felt so moved that I had to do something with my life. And this particular experience brought back a memory, how when she was 9 years old, she was hit by a driver. It was a hit-and-run situation, actually. And she would have died if strangers who saw her in the street hadn't stopped and helped her. She said, I remember this flashed back in my head so vividly, being surrounded by so much warmth and so much love, and she had a near-death experience, where she saw a beautiful light and she was told that she had to go back. And she said she knew that she was here in life for a reason. But she said, here I am, I'm in my 40s. I'm doing everything. I've got a beautiful daughter. I've got a lot to be grateful for. But I feel like I've missed something. Even with my college degrees, I'm not satisfied. My career is doing nicely. What's wrong with me? Have you ever had that feeling? Well, that's what Cass was going through. With this experience in the restaurant, the image of those three elderly ladies sitting at the table adjacent to her, she said the picture of them, she just couldn't get out of her head. And all of a sudden, an idea popped into her head. She started doing some research. Now, we've all heard about the various wish foundations that are established for children and people that are very ill. And she said, I wonder if there's anything for seniors. No such organization existed. So she created it. That's right. And this is what it's called. It's called the Twilight Wish Foundation. Isn't that nice? Twilight Wish Foundation. You can go to twilightwish.org. And she said it's to grant wishes for low-income seniors. So she started visiting nursing homes. And she would ask the seniors, what do you wish for? Now, you have to remember, a lot of these seniors can't walk anymore, or they might be in wheelchairs. They may have physical disabilities. Well, she was getting all kinds of information. There was one lady who was a waitress. She'd wanted to go back to a place she had worked in for 50 years and make milkshakes for customers. There was another woman that had been permanently handicapped by a drunken driver hitting her vehicle, and she was in a wheelchair. But she said, I want to do art, and I have no art supply. She had no money. Well, guess what? Cass's organization started getting donations from people, and they started bringing art supplies to this one lady who wanted to do art to uplift other people's lives. And she just said there were so many requests. It really were not a lot of money to be able to bring about. And then there was a wish. This I just loved. It was an 82-year-old woman, Marguerite Kirsch. She had always wanted to travel around the country in an 18-wheel rig. Can you imagine? 82 years old. It took 3 years to do this, but Cass made it happen. And when she climbed into the rig, she was just thrilled. In 16 days, she went through 27 states, stopping to deliver a chairlift in Pittsburgh and a tilting wheel in Denver. And this was to fill the wishes from some other seniors. Amazing accomplishments, but then the real kicker was the 100-year-old Miriam Claus. This woman wanted a hot air balloon ride. And I've got a photo of the two of them, Cass and Miriam. She got to go on her hot air balloon ride. And this woman, who used to be a librarian, was retired. Now, there's 16 chapters of Twilight Wish Foundation across 40 states. And she said, we have requests from new dentures to riding afloat in a Thanksgiving parade, hot air balloons, a veteran going to the World War II Memorial, a 69-year-old woman who wants to dance with the Rockettes. Yes, they're getting it done. Cass said, I now know what was missing in my life. When you do good for other people, you touch your own soul. And that's why making others' wishes come true, I feel blessed. Cass has enabled 2,000 wishes to come true for seniors. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You never know how your light of your own individuality is going to touch the lives of other people. Never give up on your dreams. Never give up on who you are as a person. Take joy. There's only one of you. We're not clones, you know. We're all individuals. And isn't that delightful? Just like Cass, one person can make a difference. And you are that special individual. Thank you for joining me today. I'm so delighted you've been able to spend this time with me. We'll be back here, same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com. This is Donna Sebo. God bless. Have a magnificent day wherever you are. Life is good. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.